From the teen who opened fire at a school killing 17 students to the man who beat his mother to death, we delve into the minds of these disturbed individuals and examine the impact their actions have on their own lives and those around them. Brace yourself for a gripping and eye-opening journey into the world of mentally ill teens dealing with life sentences. It was a seemingly ordinary day in Wesha, Wisconsin, but little did anyone know that a sinister plot was about to unfold. On May 31, 2014, two 12-year-old girls, Morgan Geer and Anissa Weir, embarked on a path of darkness that would shock the world. Anissa and Morgan were not your typical teenagers. They were drawn to the dark corners of the internet, where they stumbled upon a character who would become their obsession, Slender Man. This tall, thin figure with a featureless, white face and head lurking deep in the woods captured their imaginations and twisted their young minds. The girls believed that Slender Man was not just a figment of their imagination, but a real entity that demanded sacrifices. They became convinced that to prove their loyalty they had to carry out a heinous act, the murder of their friend Peyton Lutner. On that fateful day, under the guise of playing hide and seek, Anissa and Morgan lured Peyton to a wooded area near Waukesha. They immobilized Peyton and attacked her brutally and mercilessly, stabbing her 19 times with a knife. Miraculously, Peyton managed to crawl to a nearby road where she was discovered by a passing cyclist. "Dispatcher, are you with this 12-year-old girl?" "Yes, she says she is having trouble breathing. She says she was stabbed multiple times." Anissa and Morgan's reign of terror came to an end when they were arrested several hours later. The trial of Anissa Weir and Morgan Geer sent shockwaves across the country as the world watched in disbelief at the unimaginable depths of their actions. Anissa Weir and Morgan Geer are accused of stabbing their classmate 19 times. In order to please a fictional character, Anissa pleaded guilty to attempted second-degree murder and pleaded not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. The defense argued that her involvement in the crime was the result of her delusional beliefs and poor judgment. In the end, Anissa Weir was found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, while Morgan Geer was found competent to stand trial. The stark contrast in their trial outcomes led many to question the complexities of the justice system and its treatment of people with mental health issues. Just before Weir was sentenced, she apologized for her role in the Slender Man stabbing. "Weir, I want everyone involved to know that I am deeply sorry for everything that happened that day. Well, for now, we also have breaking news from Waukesha County, where Anissa Weir has learned that she will spend the next 25 years in a mental health institution. Anissa was sentenced to 25 years to life in a mental health institution where she will receive the necessary treatment and supervision. Although her back was to the camera, Anissa Weir showed no emotion as the judge read her sentence. "Zachary Davis, officer. What makes you laugh, Davis?" "Several things, officer, several things. Give me an example, Davis." "Well, I was laughing my ass off when I killed my mother." "Officer, what were you laughing at, Davis?" "I was laughing when I killed my mother." Next, we delve into the disturbing case of Zachary Davis, a mentally ill teenager whose life took a dark turn, culminating in a horrifying act of violence that would forever haunt a middle-class Tennessee family. It all began in the quiet town of Hendersonville, Tennessee, on a hot summer day in August 2012. Zachary Davis, a troubled 15-year-old boy, was about to embark on a path that would shatter the lives of those around him. But what drove him to commit such a heinous act? To understand the depths of Zachary's darkness, we must first explore his troubled past. Zachary's life was marred by tragedy from an early age. In 2007, his father succumbed to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as ALS, a debilitating disease that gradually robbed him of his ability to move and speak. This devastating loss had a profound impact on young Zachary, who struggled to cope with the absence of his beloved father. Little did he know that this loss would be the catalyst for the horrors that awaited him. As Zachary grew older, signs of mental illness began to manifest. Diagnosed with schizophrenia and depressive disorder, illnesses that plagued his mind and distorted his perception of reality. Voices echoed in his head, a constant presence that fueled his inner turmoil. Despite the urgency of therapy and treatment, Zachary's mother, in her desperation for a fresh start, prematurely pulled him out of therapy in the hopes that a change of scenery would bring solace to their fractured lives. The family relocated to Sumner County in search of a new beginning, but the darkness lingered inside Zachary. He became an outcast, isolated from his peers and consumed by a morbid fascination with serial killers and violent video games. It was a dangerous combination that would soon have dire consequences. On the night of the tragic incident, Zachary, his mother, and older brother went to see a movie together, unaware that their lives were about to be shattered. As they returned home, a sense of unease hung in the air, a foreboding presence that would soon reveal itself in the most horrific way imaginable. Deep in the basement, Sacharius swung a sledgehammer, a tool that would become an instrument of unspeakable violence. With a heart filled with darkness and a mind clouded by his illness, he launched a ruthless attack on his own mother, bludgeoning her to death with a ferocity that defied comprehension. But Satter's sinister plan. Driven by a twisted desire to extinguish any vestige of his family, he set fire to the family playroom with the intention of ending his older brother's life as well. However, fate intervened, as a fire alarm awakened his brother, allowing him to escape the clutches of death. Interviewer, did you kill your mother? Davis. Yes, interviewer, and why did you kill her? She wasn't taking care of my family. Authorities quickly arrived on the scene, greeted by a horrific sight. A remorseless Zachary confessed to his heinous crimes, claiming that his late father's voice had commanded him to commit these unimaginable acts of horror. The ensuing trial was a battle between the prosecution's call for justice and the defense's plea for leniency due to Sahari's severe mental illness. After 3 hours of deliberations, the jury returned its verdict: guilty of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, and aggravated arson. Zachary Davis, a mentally ill teenager, was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 51 years before parole eligibility. As the judge read the sentence, Davis stood motionless, staring blankly into space. Jeffrey Hazelwood. Next up, the disturbing case of Jeffrey Hazelwood, born October 27, 1995, in Roswell, Georgia. Hazelwood exhibited signs of mental instability that were often overlooked or misunderstood. As a child, he had difficulty socializing and displayed erratic behavior that worried his family and teachers. During his teenage years, Hazelwood's mental health deteriorated further. He became increasingly isolated, withdrew from social activities, and displayed signs of aggression. His parents, desperate for answers, sought professional help, but the full extent of his illness remained unknown. As Hazelwood entered his teenage years, his behavior took a darker turn. He developed an unhealthy fascination with violence and death and often expressed disturbing thoughts and fantasies. It was during this time that he began to harbor deep-seated anger and resentment toward society. The motive for the murders of Carter Davis and Natalie Henderson remains a mystery, but it is believed that Hazelwood's deteriorating mental state played a significant role. The victims, both innocent high school students with promising futures, were tragically caught in the crosshairs of Hazelwood's troubled mind. On the night of July 31, 2016, Carter and Natalie found themselves behind the local convenience store, unaware of the danger lurking in the shadows. It was Hazelwood, armed with a firearm, who approached Ellos and committed the heinous act that would forever change the lives of his loved ones. Roswell, a town known for its tranquility, was now dealing with the aftermath of a brutal and senseless crime. As the investigation unfolded, police turned their attention to Hazelwood, whose erratic behavior and troubled past made him the prime suspect. Hazelwood, on the other hand, claimed that a voice in his head told him to commit the shooting. "Officer, why would the bad guy have you? That's the story we're going with. The invisible bad guy who looks just like you. Give me a break." Hazelwood. "I don't remember. The courtroom became a battleground of competing narratives. The prosecution argued that Hazelwood's actions were premeditated and calculated, fueled by a wave of deep-seated anger and resentment. They presented evidence that painted him as a cold, calculating killer capable of heinous acts. The defense, on the other hand, painted a different picture. They highlighted Hazelwood's long history of mental instability and presented evidence of his deteriorating mental health in the lead-up to the murders. They argued that his illness had clouded his judgment and impaired his ability to fully comprehend the consequences of his actions. As the trial drew to a close, the jury faced the daunting task of reaching a verdict. They had to weigh the evidence presented, considering both the heinous nature of the crimes and the potential impact of Hazelwood's mental illness. It was a decision that would shape the lives of all involved. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In the courtroom, Hazelwood's reaction to his life sentence was chilling. His handcuffed hands shook uncontrollably, and he seemed to stare across the courtroom as if he were afraid of someone or something. It was as if he had detached himself from the reality of his actions, retreating into the depths of his troubled mind. Nicholas Cruz's school day began as an ordinary day and was nearly over when gunshots rang out this afternoon. It was a sunny afternoon on February 14, 2018, when the tranquility of Parkland, Florida, was shattered by a horrific act of violence. At the center of this tragedy was Nicholas Cruz, a troubled and mentally ill teenager whose actions would forever change the lives of countless others. To understand the events leading up to that fateful day, we must delve into Cruz's troubled history. Born on September 24, 1998, in Margate, Florida, Nicholas Jacob Cruz had a tumultuous childhood that would shape his path into darkness. Cruz's childhood was marked by instability and loss. His father passed away when he was just a child, leaving him and his younger brother in the care of their adoptive mother, Linda Cruz. However, tragedy struck again when Linda succumbed to an illness in November 2017, leaving her siblings orphaned. With the loss of his mother, Cruz's mental health began to deteriorate rapidly. He struggled with depression, anxiety, and anger management issues that manifested in disturbing ways. His behavior became increasingly erratic, causing concern among those who knew him. On social media, Cruz's disturbing posts and comments painted a troubling picture. He expressed racist, anti-Semitic, and xenophobic views, revealing a deep-rooted hatred that would later manifest in his violent acts. These online rantings offered a window into the troubled mind of a young man teetering on the edge of darkness. Cruz's disruptive behavior eventually caught the attention of officials at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where he was enrolled. Due to his alarming behavior, he was expelled from the school in 2017. Remarkably, despite his troubled history and concerning behavior, Cruz was able to legally purchase firearms. He acquired an arsenal of weapons, including an AR-15-style rifle, which would become the instrument of destruction on that fateful day. On February 14, 2018, Cruz arrived at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School armed and filled with a chilling determination. As students went about their day, unaware of the impending horror, Cruz unleashed a barrage of gunfire, indiscriminately targeting anyone in his path. Tragically, 17 innocent lives were taken and another 17 were wounded both physically and emotionally. The Parkland community was left reeling from the unimaginable pain and trauma inflicted by the twisted actions of one individual. The trial that followed would be a long and painful process, plagued by delays and the weight of grief. Finally, in October 2022, Cruz appeared in court and pleaded guilty to all charges. The jury, faced with overwhelming evidence, recommended a sentence that would ensure he would never walk free again. We now move on to Florida, where Parkland gunman Nicholas Cruz came face to face with the families of his victims. Tonight, he was formally sentenced to 34 consecutive life sentences. Cruz showed no emotion and remained impassive as the judge read out his multiple life sentences. He was sentenced to 34 consecutive life sentences, without the possibility of parole, a reflection of the severity of his crimes. Nahima Grigo, tonight we are learning more disturbing details of a mass murder in Albuquerque's South Valley. 15-year-old Nahima Grigo is in jail after telling investigators that he shot and killed his parents and three younger siblings. In the quiet suburbs of New Mexico, a seemingly ordinary family lived a life filled with love, faith, and dreams for the future. But behind closed doors, a storm was brewing unbeknownst to the world. This is the story of Nehemiah Grigo, a troubled teenager whose life took a dark and tragic turn. Nehemiah was born into the close-knit Greek family, led by his father Greg Grigo, a respected former pastor and chaplain for the Albuquerque Fire Department. His mother, Sarah, was a loving and devoted wife and mother to their four children. Growing up, Nehemiah was described as a bright and talented young man who was passionate about music and dreamed of serving his country in the military. He played several musical instruments and had a natural talent that impressed those around him. But beneath the surface, Nehemiah battled demons that no one could see. His mind was plagued by dark thoughts, a constant struggle between his desire for a normal life and the overwhelming weight of his mental illness. Relatives of the Grigo family have since come forward, shedding light on Nehemiah's troubled upbringing. They speak of a young man deeply affected by family dysfunction, a toxic environment that exacerbated his already fragile mental state. Despite the difficulties, Nehemiah's family remained hopeful for his future. They believed in his potential and did everything they could to support him, unaware of the darkness that consumed their son. As Nehemiah entered his teenage years, his mental health began to deteriorate rapidly. He became increasingly isolated and distanced himself from friends and loved ones. The signs of his inner turmoil were there, but no one could have predicted the terrible events that were about to unfold. As Nehemiah Grigo's mental health deteriorated, his thoughts became increasingly sinister, leading him down a path of darkness from which there would be no return. In this episode, we uncover the events that unfolded in the days leading up to the tragic mass shooting that shocked the nation. It was a crisp January morning when Nehemiah's troubled mind reached its breaking point. Armed with his father's rifles, he embarked on a chilling mission that would forever shape the community of South Valley, New Mexico. On that fateful day, Nehemiah turned his home into a house of horrors. He methodically killed his parents, Greg and Sarah Grigo, and his three young siblings, leaving a trail of devastation in his wake. The details of the crime are as chilling as they are heartbreaking. Nehemiah used two different weapons to carry out the murders, his actions fueled by a combination of homicidal and suicidal thoughts that had consumed his troubled mind. But the horror did not end there. Nehemiah had planned to continue his rampage by taking more innocent lives before engaging in a deadly shootout with police. It was a chilling plot that was fortunately thwarted before it could be carried out. The community was left reeling, struggling to comprehend the magnitude of the tragedy that had unfolded in their midst. The loss of five lives, including three innocent children, sent shockwaves across the country and ignited an intense debate about mental health and its implications. In the wake of the mass shooting, investigators worked tirelessly to piece together the events leading up to this unimaginable act of violence. Mental health evaluations revealed the extent of Nehemiah's illness, shedding light on the torment that had consumed his young mind. Nehemiah Greek was charged with two counts of murder and three counts of child abuse resulting in death. He initially pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, but later, after further evaluation, changed his plea and accepted responsibility for his actions. Just before he was sentenced, Greek apologized to his family in the courtroom. "I'm sorry I took our parents and our siblings. I wish I could take this back, but the reality is I can't." Ultimately, the court sentenced Nehemiah as an adult to three concurrent life sentences plus 7 years. A decision that would forever alter the course of his life. Despite the harsh sentence, Grigo, who had his back to the camera, showed no sign of agitation or fear of his punishment. Instead, his disposition reflected resignation or acceptance. Daniel William Marsh. Today we delve into the twisted mind of Daniel William Marsh, a a name that will forever be associated with darkness and brutality. Born on May 14, 1997, Marsha's troubled journey began long before that fateful day in Davis, California. Growing up in Davis, Marsha's childhood was marred by a series of warning signs that hinted at the darkness that lurked within him. From an early age, he displayed signs of violent and antisocial behavior, causing concern among those who knew him. As Marsh entered his teens, his fascination with death took a sinister turn. Began to harbor dark fantasies of becoming a serial killer, a desire that would eventually manifest itself in the most horrifying of ways. Consumed by his twisted fantasies, Marsh meticulously planned his descent into darkness. He studied the methods of infamous serial killers, learning their techniques and strategies. He was determined to leave his mark on the world, to become a name whispered in fear. But what led Marsh down this path of darkness? Was it a result of his upbringing, or was there something inherently broken within him? Marsh's childhood was anything but idyllic. He grew up in a broken home, plagued by domestic violence and neglect. The scars of his turbulent upbringing would shape the person he would become. As Marsh's mental health deteriorated, he was diagnosed with major depression, anxiety, and adjustment disorder. The psychologists who evaluated him described him as a psychopath and sexual sadist, painting a chilling picture of a young man teetering on the edge of sanity. But despite his troubled past and mental health issues, nothing could excuse the horrors Marsh would unleash on that fateful day in Davis. On April 14, 2013, Marsh's dark fantasies became a horrifying reality. He entered the home of Oliver Chip Northup Jr. and Claudia Maupin, a well-respected couple in their community. As the couple slept, Marsh attacked them with a ferocity that can only be described as pure evil. He stabbed them multiple times, reveling in their pain and suffering. But the horror didn't end there. Marsh mutilated their bodies, leaving behind a scene of unimaginable carnage. It was a crime that would forever scar the Davis community and send shockwaves across the nation. The woman woke up, so I started stabbing her over and over again all over her torso and I tried to. And then the husband woke up. And he looked over. Just as he looked over, I stabbed him in the neck. The trial of Daniel William Marsh, which began on September 2, 2014, lasted 5 weeks, captivating the nation with its shocking revelations and disturbing glimpses into the mind of a killer. Marsh, tried as an adult despite being a minor at the time of the crimes, faced 2 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances. The prosecution, led by experienced counsel, presented a compelling case against Marsh. They meticulously presented the evidence, describing a calculated and premeditated crime. Surveillance footage, forensic reports, and witness testimony all pointed to Marsh's guilt. Marsh's defense attorney, a skilled litigator, sought to rebut the prosecution's version of events. They argued that Marsh's actions were the result of a combination of medication side effects and mental illness. They painted a picture of a troubled young man who was out of control over his actions. The defense presented expert witnesses and psychologists who had evaluated Marsh's mental state. They described him as a troubled individual, diagnosed with major depression, anxiety, and an adjustment disorder. These diagnoses, they argued, played a significant role in his behavior. Ultimately, it was up to the jury to decide whether Marsh was a cold-blooded killer or a troubled young man who deserved understanding and rehabilitation. After days of deliberations, they reached a verdict. He was found guilty of both counts of first-degree murder and all special circumstances. Jurors were then asked to determine whether Marsh was sane or insane, and on September 30th, the jury found that Marsh was, in fact, sane when he committed the murders. The judge, considering the seriousness of the crimes and the impact on the victims' families, imposed the maximum sentence of 52 years to life in prison. It was a sentence that left no room for leniency. As the judge read his verdict, Marsh stood with his head bowed, showing no emotion. Rod Farrell. Finally, we discover the chilling story of Rod Farrell, a mentally ill teenager whose life took a dark and twisted turn. From his involvement with the notorious vampire clan to the brutal murders that landed him a life sentence, Farrell's story will leave you horrified and intrigued. In the quiet town of Murray, Kentucky, a darkness was brewing just beneath the surface. It was there that a young man named Rod Farrell would embark on a path that would lead him to unimaginable horrors. Born on March 28, 1980, Rod seemed like an ordinary child, but no one knew the darkness that lurked within. As a teenager, Rod Farrell began to show signs of a disturbed mind, drawn to the macabre, fascinated by the occult, and immersed himself in the world of role-playing games. It was through one game in particular, Vampire: The Masquerade, Rod's obsession with vampires. He became convinced that he was a 500-year-old vampire named Basago, a delusion that would have devastating consequences. It was during this vulnerable time that he found solace in a group of like-minded individuals who shared his fascination with the occult. This group, known as the Vampire Clan, was made up of teenagers united by their common interests and their desire to escape the mundane reality of their lives. Led by Rod Farrell, they delved into their fantasies that blurred the lines between fiction and reality. They believed they were vampires, living in a world where their darkest desires could be fulfilled. But for Rod Farrell, it was no game. He truly believed that he possessed supernatural powers and was destined for greatness. This belief, coupled with his troubled mental state, would lead him down a path of destruction. In the summer of 1996, Rod met Heather Wendolf, a young woman who would become a pivotal figure in his life. Heather was living in an abusive home, desperate to escape the torment she endured on a daily basis. Rod saw himself as her savior, her knight in shining armor, and vowed to help her break free from the chains that bound her. Together, Rod and Heather hatched a plan to escape their troubled lives. They enlisted the help of Rod's accomplices, Scott Anderson, Dana Cooper, and Charity Kissy, all members of the Vampire Clan. They planned to leave Murray, Kentucky, behind and start anew, embracing their vampire identities and living a life of freedom, but their journey would take a dark and sinister turn. On November 25, 1996, Rod Farrell and Scott Anderson embarked on a fateful road trip that would forever change their lives and the lives of those they crossed. Their destination was Eustis, Florida, the home of Heather's parents, Richard Wendorf and Naomi Ruth Queen. Little did Richard and Naomi know that their daughter's friend, Rod Farrell, harbored a deep-seated rage and bloodlust. That fateful night, Rod and Scott entered the Wendorf residence, armed with a crowbar and filled with determination. Richard Wendorf, unaware of the horror that awaited him, was brutally beaten to death by Rod Farrell. The violence did not stop there. When Naomi Ruth Queen stumbled upon the gruesome scene, she too fell victim to Rod's unrelenting fury. As news of the murders spread, Rod and his accomplices fled, embarking on a four-day road trip that would ultimately lead to their capture. It was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that their journey came to an end, when law enforcement apprehended the Vampire Clan and brought them to justice. The arrest of Rod Farrell and his accomplices marked the beginning of a legal battle that would captivate the nation. Farrell pleaded guilty to the murders but maintained that his fellow inmates were innocent. His defense team argued that he suffered from mental illness, citing disorders such as schizotypal personality disorder and Asperger's syndrome. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the defendant has pleaded guilty to two counts of first-degree murder on counts 3 and 4 of the indictment. Accordingly, you will not be concerned with the question of his guilt. The punishment for these crimes is death or life in prison. Rod Farrell was initially sentenced to death, a punishment that reflected the heinous nature of his crimes. However, his sentence was later reduced to life in prison, sparing him the maximum penalty. His accomplices were also sentenced to prison for their roles in the murders. Rod Farrell stood stoically, his face devoid of any emotion as he learned his fate. Farrell's accomplices, Scott Anderson, Dana Cooper, and Charity Kissy, were also sentenced to prison for their roles in the murders. However, their sentences were not as severe as Farrell's, as the jury took into account their lesser involvement in the crimes. As we reflect on the chilling stories of these teens, let's always remember to pay special attention to the mental health of those around us. If you found this video informative and thought-provoking, Be sure to click on the cards that appear on your screen, and I'll be back with more captivating content. Yes.